Today, are the bears caged for now? The Property Imperative Weekly to the 17th of August 2019. Welcome to my latest digest of finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The week in which the financial markets flip-flopped, an inverted yield curve became mainstream, CoreLogic's property index in Australia did a sudden reversal, ASIC lost the responsible lending case against Westpac, and the New South Wales Building Inquiry heard just how bad the issues around recent high-rise construction are. So lots to cover today. And let's get started with the international financial markets. But if you want to go straight to the Australian section, the time code is shown below. And in the comments, I've also set out the times for the main segments that we're going to cover today. So if you want to jump to one of those, you can do that too. Friday was an up day as US stocks rebounded, bonds rallied, and news of potential economic stimulus by China, Germany, and the ECB helped to bring buyers back to the equity markets. Positive US retail sales data also supported the rally. In fact, US retail sales came in ahead of expectations, rising by 0.7% in July. Stripping out autos and volatile items, retail sales were even stronger, rising by 1% over the month. And accounting for CPI movements, it appears that real retail sales have continued their trend expansion, with year-ended growth slowing fractionally to 3.5% from 3.7%. So on those numbers, the US consumer is still spending, but the policy shocks are actually now more significant in our view, especially trade and monetary policy. So while all three major US stock averages ended the session higher, they still logged their third consecutive weekly losses, having been rattled since Monday by growing US-China trade animosity, simmering geopolitical tensions, and signals from the bond market that sparked fears of impending recession. The stock index dropped, of course, 800 points on Wednesday, and it has still lost 4.5% from its July 26 record, and it recently posted its worst 2 days of 2019. Bonds, meanwhile, saw their two best days as buyers sought shelter from gathering clouds. The volatility or fear index was down 12.8% to 1847, but it is still reflecting the heightened uncertainty. And on Friday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 1.2% to 25,886. The S&P 500 gained 1.44% to 2,888, and the Nasdaq Composite added 1.67% to 7,895. The Dow's gain was its second of more than 300 points during the week. Four of the Dow's five sessions ended with daily gains or losses of more than 300 points, including that big 800-point loss. Traders will love the volatility, as it's when they're making money, but retail investors less so. The Dow ended the week down 1.53%, the S&P 500 was off 1.03%, and the Nasdaq was down 0.8% over the week, but the declines were the third straight for each index and their fourth losses in 5 weeks. The major averages have fallen back after hitting new highs back in July, mostly because of the Trump administration's threats to impose new tariffs on imports from China starting September the 1st. Despite Friday's gains, the Dow was off 5.5% from its July peak, with the S&P 500 down 4.6%, and the Nasdaq down 5.3%. The trade tensions actually eased a bit after President Donald Trump agreed to delay tariffs on many products, especially electronics and other consumer goods, ahead of the holiday shopping season. They seemed to ease more on Friday, if only because there were a few ugly tweets or other pronouncements. It's not clear if the two sides are embarked on trying to resolve their differences with less incendiary rhetoric. So volatility is likely to continue. And GE dropped significantly after the Bernie Madoff whistleblower called into question GE's accounting policies. They dropped to 8.01 before bouncing back. Some traders will have made a profit, but perhaps the market appears now to have shrugged this off, at least at the moment. The chart of the Russell 2000, though, is looking slightly head and shoulderish. It makes the current level around 1450 very important. If the index breaks that level, chartists will take it as a terrible sign, suggesting a decline to significantly lower levels. In short, if your biggest concern in 2019 was that signals sent by dueling rallies in stocks and bonds were in disagreement, well, you can stop worrying about that now and start worrying about what it all means now that they actually agree. Interest rates moved higher as investors seemed willing to buy stocks after so much volatility. The 10-year Treasury yield rose to 1.559% after hitting a low of 1.475% on Thursday, and the 2-year Treasury yield fell to 1.489%. The 2-10 yield curve inverted for the first time since 2007. Gold futures was down 0.48% to 1,523, and crude oil rose 0.83% to 54.92. The euro-US dollar was down 0.14% to 1.1091, and the US dollar index was up 0.06% to 98.06. German stocks rose with the DAX up 1.3% on the news that Angela Merkel is looking for ways to run larger budget deficits than normally allowed when German manufacturing is falling back. Germany's coalition government is willing to suspend its balanced budget rule and take on debt. According to Der Spiegel magazine, rising hopes that Europe's largest economy could steer itself away from recession and cooling worries over a global economic slowdown. But think about it. In fact, this may amplify the growing uncertainty and so weaken markets later. You've got to ask the question, is more debt good debt? German stimulus hopes helped the benchmark US Treasury yield rise from 3-year lows, having previously dipped below those of 2-year notes, which is seen by many as a classic recessionary red flag. The amount of reporting on the inversion, which, by the way, has since corrected, belies the fact that the 3-month and 1-year bonds have been inverted against the 10 years for some time, but it sure spooked the markets. So is recession coming? Well, not according to the bankers, as this brief segment shows.
You know, I think if you go back and look, you know, people say, what's this environment like? It was like 3/4 of this decade so far, if you really think about it, where the U.S. economy was recovering and growing, and yet the economies around the world were struggling. And then we had synchronized growth for about a half a year, if you remember, a few years back, and it, when Europe started growing and people felt good about Europe as it moved above 1 to 1.5, and people were feeling good. So I think the reality is the United States can help push along because it's sheer size. The U.S. spends on healthcare what the entire Indian GDP is. So, and that's the 5th or 6th largest economy. So think about the context, which, so as long as the U.S. goes, it can help. It would sure help if Europe, which is a similar size economy, add all together, was growing faster. It's slowing down, but that's the reality. So I think it's tougher sledding for the U.S. economy to carry its weight today. But it, and then the additional uncertainty around trade and how it's going to impact business plans and capital investment is really the concern. But the U.S. can do a lot to carry the world. It's just that it has to really be set up to really be pushing.
But negative interest rates are in vogue now. German government bonds with maturities going right out to 30 years now trade with negative interest rates. UBS Group plans to charge an annual fee of 0.6% for some wealthy clients to hold their money. And in Denmark, as we covered last week, a bank is selling for the first time a mortgage-backed note that carries a negative coupon. Negative rates are showing up everywhere, seemingly turning on their heads traditional notions of lending and borrowing. Negative yields just don't seem to make any sense. A lender is supposed to get paid to part with capital, while a borrower is supposed to pay for the use of that cash for some purpose. So it seems crazy that anyone would voluntarily part with their money only to end up with less of it. As Bloomberg put it, there's a reason Europe is ground zero for the explosion in negative rates. Growth has been mediocre, seemingly forever. There is still tons of wealth, and beyond that, there's a relative shortage of stable institutions in which to park money. Think about Switzerland, where, like Germany, the entire yield curve is negative, all the way out to 50-year bonds. It's one of the most stable banking centres that has ever existed, and it's surrounded by a sea of people who have just been involved in scares relating to frail banks and risky government bonds. Naturally, if you're rich and in Europe, you'd like to hold your money at UBS. And since UBS doesn't have unlimited capacity to pay you interest on your holdings, well, you've got to pay UBS for the privilege of holding your money there. Sorry about that, but what other choice do you have? One thing that does seem clear is that while central bankers who are now embarking on yet another global easing round may be able to keep growth alive, but they haven't really figured out how to change the overall rate trajectory. So some new policy prescription probably needs to be tried. In fact, some would say we've reached the end of the monetary policy journey. And in the meantime, there's lots of money out there and a limited capacity to store it all. So increasingly, savers are going to have to pay for money storage services. And although it's not much consolation, we can at least remember that whether it's fees for oil tanks, safe deposit boxes, security guards, insurance, or wealth managers, there's nothing unnatural about being forced to pay to preserve your wealth. Welcome to the new world. And by the way, banks will do very well out of it. European shares open positively on better news about the US-China trade dispute. The technology sector led the way on the Stoxx 600 with semiconductor companies AMS, Infineon, and STMI Microelectronics making substantial gains, while chip makers NVIDIA and chip gear maker Applied Materials delivered better than expected results. But a technical glitch delayed the start of trading on Friday on the UK blue chip FTSE 100 and mid-cap stock indices for almost 2 hours in what was the longest outage at one of the world's top exchanges in 8 years. The London Stock Exchange suffered a technical software issue, which postponed the opening of trade until 8:40 GMT, a spokesman said in an email. The market normally opens at 7 a.m. In a statement on its website, it had said that they were still investigating the issue. The fault affected hundreds of shares in some of the UK's largest companies, including Shell, Unilever, HSBC, and BHP Group, worth a total of $2.8 trillion. Traders were frustrated by the latest outage, coming during a hectic week on global financial markets, hit by worries about a US recession and the US-China trade spat. This is actually the second outage at the LSE, which handles about £5 billion worth, or $6.1 billion worth, of volume each day in just over a year. The FTSE 100 was up 0.71% to end at 7,107, while the UK Financials Index was up 1.38% to 705.01. Royal Bank of Scotland was up 2.53% to 182.15. The pound US dollar was up 0.55% to 1.2150. Asian markets recovered as Chinese trade officials and President Trump boosted optimism surrounding trade talks, with the September meeting between the leaders still on track. And there were measures announced by China to support its economy, and that lifted the Hang Seng and the Shanghai Composite, and the focus seems to be on encouraging consumers to spend more. The US dollar Chinese yuan was up 0.14% to 7.0428. The Shanghai Composite was up 0.29% to 2,823.82. But Argentina was downgraded deeper into junk territory by two of the three biggest rating agencies as markets brace for a possible default after the populist opposition won the landslide victory in Sunday's primary election. Fitch Ratings cut Argentina's long-term issuer rating by 3 notches to CCC from B, putting the South American nation on par with Zambia and the Republic of Congo. S&P lowered the country's sovereign rating to B- from B and slapped a negative outlook on it. The move caps a traumatic week for Argentina that saw the peso fall to a record, the benchmark equity gauge suffer one of the worst daily routs in 70 years, and the yield on the nation's century bonds spike to an all-time high. S&P cited Argentina's vulnerable financial profile and the slump in asset prices following the primary. Argentina's currency hit its weakest ever level after Macri's loss. As of March 31st, Argentina had $33.7 billion of foreign currency debt payments due by year-end, the vast majority in short-term treasury bills, or LEDs. According to the latest debt report by the Finance Ministry, Fitch says that the deterioration in the macroeconomic environment increases the likelihood of a sovereign default or restructuring of some kind. And by year-end, Fitch projects Argentina will run a fiscal deficit of 1% of GDP, a level it expects the country to maintain through 2020. Moreover, Fitch forecasts federal government debt to GDP to rise to roughly 95% in 2019, and the economy to contract 2.5%. It may already be too late for Argentina to avoid a default. And this week's slump in assets resulted in large losses for some of the world's biggest money managers who had piled into Argentina in a search for yield. And that's an object lesson in what can happen in a crisis. In recent times, we've seen Bitcoin and gold rise in tandem during bouts of risk-off, but this relationship has broken down over the past 10 days. Gold has been seen as a safe haven, and in a world of negative yields, a gold brick that yields zero looks quite appealing. But the interesting question is whether the divergence with Bitcoin might signal buying opportunities on Bitcoin or even shorting gold. The question is Bitcoin really digital gold? Bitcoin was down 0.22% to 10,320. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. And so to the local markets, which, of course, were also hit by the waves of negativity during the week. Questions about poor quality construction rumbled on. As we discussed with our property insider Edwin Almeida some months back, Mascot Towers and Opal Tower is just the tip of a $1 trillion problem in Australia. The inquiry into New South Wales building standards, which was set up last month, continues to hear reports from apartment owners facing financial ruin after being left to foot repair bills to bring their faulty towers back to code. Apartment owners in the cracking Mascot Towers in Sydney are facing being thrown into decades of crippling debt, and some are worried that they may die before the situation gets resolved. Residents occupying the 132 apartments were forced out of their home in June after cracks were found in the primary support structure and facade. Almost 300 people have had to scramble to find other accommodation, causing considerable emotional and financial distress. The owners have been told the first of 4 stages of repairs alone could cost $10 million, a bill which they will be locked into paying back over 15 years, the owners came out in force to demand answers from the state government and warn putting this financial burden on homeowners would set, quote, a very dangerous precedent. The owners are calling for the Premier to impose better regulation, and Innovation Minister Kevin Anderson and New Building Commissioner David Chandler to attend their meeting on August the 22nd, where they will vote on whether the $10 million first stage repairs will go ahead. And you can watch our latest on this, Let the Games Begin, where Edwin updates the situation at Opal Tower, which is another example of what's going on. But remember, this is the tip of an iceberg created by poor building certification, cheap materials, and in some cases, outright fraud and deception. And this is not just a New South Wales issue, it's a national disgrace. Indeed, as reported this week, some are deciding to sell and are taking a $200,000 hit in so doing. But getting out now may indeed be the better path, and we're seeing some values falling more than 30% as units are unmortgageable and uninsurable. So more downside pressure on home prices. But on the other hand, the CoreLogic Index suddenly jumped this week. So here are the annual movements based on the CoreLogic data series. And you can see there that Sydney suddenly took a turn up over the last couple of days, as did Melbourne. No explanation as to why the index suddenly took such a large leap. Never seen that before, so not quite sure what's going on. There was almost no change in Brisbane. A little bit of an uptick in Adelaide, but not very much. And Perth moved up very slightly. And as a result of that, the overall index did move higher. But I really don't understand why the index would have moved so quickly in such a short period of time, bearing in mind that it had been moving sideways or slightly down for the previous couple of weeks. CoreLogic has offered no explanation at all. And of course, we must remember that this is on very low volumes, and it may well be that the very low volumes are introducing more noise into the series than we've traditionally seen. But I don't know, that's just speculation on my part. So turning to the CoreLogic Index weekly movements to the 15th of August, we can see that in Sydney over the last week, prices rose 0.51% thanks to that spike that we mentioned just now. Over the quarter, prices were up 0.99%. Over the last year, they're still down 8.2%. And from their peak, they're down 14.3%. In Melbourne, prices rose 0.6% over the last week, again, because of that funny spike. Over the quarter, they were up 0.87%. Annually, they've fallen 7.4%. And from peak, they're down 10.3%. In Brisbane, prices are up 0.17% over the last week. They've fallen 0.47% over the quarter. They're down 2.2% over the last year. And from their peak, they're down 2.3%. In Adelaide, prices fell 0.24% over the last week. They've fallen 0.93% over the last quarter. They're down 1.2% over the last year. And from their peak, they're down 1.6%. In Perth, they're down 0.29% over the last week. They're down 2.3% over the last quarter. They're down 8.9% over the last year. And they've fallen 20.5% from their previous peak. And the five major capital cities together were up 0.37% over the last week, up 0.28% over the last quarter, down 7% over the last year, and they're down 10.4% from peak. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the weeks ahead and whether the index continues to move in that positive direction. And I think the question will be the relationship between the more positive sentiment that we've got in the property sector at the moment relative to the broader economic conditions both here and internationally. I have a feeling that the international issues will probably come over the top. And just a reminder, one of the points I keep making is that these average indices tell you very little about the movement of individual properties, because essentially prices move in different markets at different levels for different types of properties. So these averages don't tell you the full story by any means. In some cases, we know prices have dropped 30 to 35%. In other places, they've definitely been on the rise. Depends where you buy, what you buy, and when you buy. And turning to auction clearance rates, again, they came in at 67.8% on 1,111 auctions, compared with 1,402 last year. And the numbers are skewed on these low volumes, so we remain unconvinced this marks a significant uptick in the market. We're also seeing more intending to list, especially property investors and unit holders hoping to sell into the expected spring peak. so they are looking in a way for the greater fall. We'll see. And CoreLogic said that there is still not much affordable housing around. Throughout the 2018-19 financial year, 26% of all houses sold nationally under $400,000, and 32.5% of all unit sales were under $400,000. Despite the weakening housing market, the share of house sales under $400,000 was virtually unchanged from a year ago, down from 26.3%. The previous year, while the share of unit sales under $400,000 increased from 31% over the 2017-18 financial year. Across the combined capital cities, 13.9% of house sales over the 2018-19 financial year were under $400,000, and 24.6% of unit sales were under this price point. The share of house sales under $400,000 was virtually unchanged from the previous year, recorded at 13.8%, while the share of unit sales was noticeably lower at 22.3%. Despite house and unit values falling 8.7% and 5.9% respectively over the year. Mortgage delinquency was up in June according to the Standard & Poor's Performance Index. Arrears typically decline in June and throughout the third quarter. Mortgage arrears were up 13 basis points year on year in June and above the five-year average of 1.25%. Arrears fell in Queensland, South Australia, Northern Territory and the ACT, but rose in Western Australia, Tasmania, New South Wales, and Victoria. Of course, those last two are the major populous states. Arrears continue to rise in Western Australia, despite a small improvement in May, increasing to 3.05% from 3% a month earlier. And South Australia recorded the largest month-on-month improvement, with arrears falling 5 basis points to 1.52%. Investment arrears were almost unchanged in June, falling 1 basis point to 1.47%, but owner-occupied arrears rose 1 basis point to 1.74% from a month earlier. Owner-occupied arrears have continued to rise towards their long-term peak of 1.83%, despite interest rates being around 3% lower. This reflects borrowers' increased debt serviceability pressures in a low wage growth environment, they said. And ANZ disclosed a rise in mortgage defaults this week, with mortgage delinquency up in the third quarter 2019. 90-day delinquency increased 14 basis points to 114 basis points. And on a geographic basis, there was a 9 basis point uplift in New South Wales and in Victoria on aggregate. On a product basis, around one-third of the movement came from interest-only loan conversions to principal and interest. And they said that Western Australia still leads the way, but delinquencies are also rising in the other states. Financial year 17 and financial year 18 vintages continue to perform better than financial year 15 and 16, where, of course, lending standards were at their most loose. Plus, as we know from our mortgage stress work, it can take 2 or 3 years for households in financial stress to go delinquent. ANZ's performance is likely to be biased higher, given its shrinking mortgage portfolio. And NAB also reported a rise, with their ratio of 90-day plus past due and gross impaired assets to gross loans and acceptances increased from 0.79% to 0.85%, largely due to rising mortgage delinquencies. And the economic data continues to paint a weak picture, with unemployment in trend terms up to 5.3%. The trend unemployment rate remains steady in most territories and states, except for South Australia up 0.2 percentage points and Queensland and the Northern Territory up 0.1 percentage points. As we discussed in our post, the horses are spooked. And in addition, wages growth remains anemic. The trend wage price index rose 0.5% in the June quarter 2019, and that translates to 2.3% through the year, according to figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. These are lower than projected in the budget and highlights the stress in the economy. Without one-off factors, the numbers would have been even lower. Seasonally adjusted, private sector wage growth was 0.5%, while public sector wage growth was 0.8% in the June quarter 2019. And in original terms, annual wages growth to June by industry ranged from 1.7% for wholesale trade to 3.3% for healthcare and social assistance, which, by the way, was helped by a very large rise in Victoria. Western Australia recorded the lowest through the year wage growth of 1.6%, while Victoria recorded the highest of 2.9%, again because of that significant rise in the healthcare sector. And we discussed all this in our post, Wages Weakness Continues to Rise as Confidence Falls. The confidence I was referring to came from the latest ME Bank Household Comfort Index. They said that Australian households are feeling overall worse about their net wealth, jobs, income and living expenses, with further significant residential property price falls over the past 6 months and a weakening labour market. Despite remaining a little above the report's 7-year average, they said financial comfort across most of the 11 drivers that make up the index fell, with net wealth in particular seeing the largest drop, falling 3% to 5.54 out of 10 during the 6 months to June 2019. This is largely a consequence of continued decrease in the value of residential property in many parts of Australia. About 40% of households continue to spend all of their monthly income. And Australians felt the least comfortable with their ability to cope with a financial emergency, which fell slightly by 1% to only 4.77 out of 10. Indeed, 20% of households said they didn't think they could raise $3,000 in an emergency. The number of households contributing more than 30% of disposable income towards paying off a mortgage has remained steady at around 43%, while the corresponding figure for renters has risen to a massive 62%. But this was in contrast to the latest Westpac Melbourne Institute data, which was more positive, though after a drop last month. They said that sentiment rose 3.6% to 100 in August from 96.5 in July. However, the result does come in the aftermath of an unexpected 4.7% fall in the index in June and July, and that came despite consecutive rate cuts from the RBA and the restoration of political certainty following the May federal election. So part of the gain is consistent, they said, with firming expectations for additional interest rate cuts. This is influencing consumers' views. Responses to an additional question on expectations for mortgage interest rates, which they run every 6 months, showed just 31% expect rates to be higher in a year's time, compared with 43% when the question was last run in February, and 50% this time a year ago. This, they said, is the most dovish mix of responses seen since mid-2012, when the RBA was moving through a significant policy easing cycle. Views around family finances have shown a more muted improvement. The sub-index tracking consumers' expectations for finances next 12 months rose 0.7% but remains in slightly pessimistic territory. And the finances versus a year ago sub-index lifted 0.9% to a 5-month high. The index remains at weak levels overall. And the muted gains are despite further signs of improvement, they said, in Australia's housing market and the federal government's tax relief, which may be starting to see cash flows to some households. Consumers' job loss fears eased slightly in August, and housing-related sentiment continues to show a clear positive response to lower interest rates, with assessments of both time to buy and household price expectations recording further gains in August. The time to buy a dwelling index rose 3% to 106.9, comfortably above the long-term average of 120, and the highest level seen since early 2014. Sydney and Melbourne continue to lead the turnaround, although buyer sentiment posted particularly strong gains in Western Australia and South Australia, they said. Buyer sentiment has been notably softer in Queensland. The state index was down 6.4% this month and down 11.6% on a year ago. And the Westpac Melbourne Institute Index of House Price Expectations posted a solid 5.1% increase to 125.4. The index is up 40% since May and back on a par with levels in mid-2018, though still 18% below its previous peak in March 2017. And all major states recorded a lift in price expectations this month. And the NAB Business Confidence Survey for July was unchanged from last month, the key message being that the business sector has lost significant momentum since early 2018 and that forward-looking indicators do not point to an improvement in the near term, they said. In the month, conditions edged lower, but remains within its range over the past 4 months. Confidence ticked up after a sharp fall last month and a period of volatility around the federal election. Both, they say, remain clearly below their respective long-run averages. Retail continues to be hit as households keep their wallets under tight control. The retail component of the NAB Business Survey shows a persistent fall in business conditions in the sector since early last year. Conditions in retail are now at their lowest level since the 1990 recession and below the trough seen even through the GFC. This marked deterioration in conditions come after a significant period of the industry underperforming the rest of the economy and at a time where policymakers have begun to provide some support to households through lower interest rates and tax relief. So there are no signs of life for wages growth there. And finally, ASIC lost its responsible lending case with Westpac, and it means household expenditure measures, the HEM, in their revised forms will continue to be used to assess mortgage borrowers' capacity, particularly looking at their expenses, at least until ASIC releases its revised guidelines later in the year. And I discuss the implications of this in our post, Are the Mortgage Lending Taps About to Open? My view is maybe a little, but as Westpac made clear on Friday, they are now on notice and are asking for a lot more detail on the expenses side of the ledger than they used to. So I'm not sure that we're going to see a significant change, though when you add in the rate cuts, the reduction on benchmark rates from APRA, and the RBA calling for the banks to lend, as well as government, of course, imploring people to take a chance, we do expect some bounce in credit ahead. The question is, will the fading international conditions dampen the impact? And will consumers and households take the bait? Remember, debt is ultra high, and home prices are still over 40% above their natural levels. I was interested to see Nine has reposted the segment on YouTube we did in 60 Minutes on home prices last year, where I cited the risks from an international crisis. And I still stand by what I said. This is looking right in the teeth of a gale, and that gale could lead us to a recession. A lot of people bought in relatively recently with massively large mortgages, highly leveraged. The banks were way too loose in their lending standards. So we have a lot of people with not much wiggle room now. You can't refinance because nobody will refinance you. You can't sell the property because there's not enough equity. I mean, that's a nightmare scenario, but it's not completely unrealistic.
So you think it's very clear that it's so many of the people that we see on the brink now have almost been set up to fail by the bank?
There is no doubt that they've got loans they should never have got.
How much does Australia have tied up in mortgages?
So there's $1.7 trillion held by the banks in mortgages for owner occupiers and investors. And that's about 65% of their total lending. That's higher than any other country in the Western world by a long way.
Data scientist Martin North of Digital Finance Analytics says the problem is blindingly obvious. Australia is addicted to debt.
There's probably no country in the world more susceptible to the ramifications of a housing crash than Australia.
we are uniquely exposed at the moment because as a society and as a government and as a regulatory system, we're all banking on the home price engine. Just goes on giving and giving and giving, right? But it's not going to.
Now traders are standing there watching in amazement.
I'm drawing parallels Australia now and where the US was in 2006 and 2007. We've got a debt bomb, we've got a debt crisis, and at some point it's going to explode in our face.
Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinct...
Martin streams advice and data to the market based on his surveys of homeowners in mortgage distress. What he's seeing out there are more and more of us going deeper and deeper into the red.
At the worst end of the spectrum, if everything turned against us, we could see property prices 40 to 45% down from their peaks, which is a huge deal.
And more about our scenarios in our live show next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Sydney time. You can join me live to ask a question or send one in beforehand via the DFA blog. The links are below. And so, to the markets. At the time of recording, the ASX 100 was at 5,305, and that's up 0.02%. The ASX Financials Index was up 0.67% to end at 6,054. And the local volatility index in Australia was down 4.36% to end at 1,875. ANZ was up 0.61% to 26.39. CBA was up 1.05% to end at 75.12. NAB was up 0.86% to 27.03. And Westpac was up 0.76% to end at 27.82. Among the regionals, the Bank of Queensland was up 0.34% to 8.80. Bendigo Bank was up 0.76% to 10.58. Suncorp was up 0.08% to 1310. Macquarie was up 0.46% to 118.54. And AMP fell another 4.93% to 174. So any lift that it might have got from its earlier announcements with regard to restructuring have now completely dissipated. Lenders mortgage insurer Genworth was up 3.46 to 299. The real estate agency McGrath was down 4.26% to 22.5 cents, and the Ellerbrick Rail was at 1.47% to 6.9 cents. Mortgage Choice was up 0.92% to 1.10. And the Aussie US dollar was up 0.04% to 67.81. The Aussie Gold Cross was down 0.67% to 22.32. And the Bitcoin Aussie Cross was up 0.19% to end at 15,324. And always willing to please, here is the Euro-Australian dollar cross, which was down 0.18% to 1.6355, as requested last week. And by the way, I just want to say thank you very much to all those subscribers who've got us now to more than 25,000 subscribers on the channel. Really appreciate your support. Please continue to share and subscribe to our work as we continue to tell the story of the evolving economy. And we also hit 117,000 views on our post relating to the cash ban. And in fact, there'll be a post coming up quite soon where we go into more detail about what happens next. And specifically, we speak to a Member of Parliament to talk about their perspective on this bill. And in summary, the weight of evidence still points to heightened downside risks ahead. Of course, the unholy alliance of bankers, the real estate sector, and politicians will talk things up. But the data points to weaker fundamentals, and I place much more confidence in the data, warts and all, compared with that unholy alliance. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.